Hello and welcome to The Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fosbero. Today's guest is Amma Latif. I met Amma last summer when I was doing interviews on stage in a massive barn for BBC One's Countryfile. He was a guest at their Castle Howard event. Amma went blind when he was 18. He was born with a degenerative eye condition, which his parents, originally from Pakistan, knew would eventually lead to full sight loss. Once he went blind, Amma's life quickly seemed completely defined by it. He was fed up of being told what he couldn't do. People said he couldn't study maths at university. He got a 2-1 from Strathclyde. He couldn't go abroad for his gap year. He studied in Canada. And there was no way he could follow his dream to become an accountant. He became head of commercial finance for BT. Amma is an entrepreneur. He set up and runs the world's first travel company for blind and sighted travellers, Travelize. He's a TV presenter and, as I know only too well, firsthand, an ambitious adventurer. Well, more on that later, but Amma joins me from his home in Leeds. Amma, very lovely to speak to you today. You've been in hospital, seriously ill with COVID-19. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling incredibly well. It was such a terrifying experience. I thought this was it, that was going to be the end of me. But coming out of hospital, I am so, so happy that I can breathe, that I'm alive, that I'm back in my apartment. So it's changed my mindset even more.
Well, we'll talk later about your experience with the virus. It's very nice to hear you back to your old self. Start off, Amma, take us back to growing up and your childhood in Glasgow.
Well, when I was 4, the doctors told my parents that I would become blind. And so in my mid to late teens, and I remember growing up and, you know, losing my sight a little bit to this condition called RP, retinitis pigmentosa. So at school, they moved my desk to the front of the class. When I was playing rugby, I'd missed the ball. So I felt different. I really struggled. And then I remember when I was 18 years old, I woke up and I had this poster at the end of my bed and I couldn't see it. So I closed my eyes and tried to, you know, rub, thinking, oh, it's just morning eye stuff going on. And I couldn't see it. And I remember that day I was walking around, crashing into tables and chairs, and I couldn't see the faces of my family. Couldn't see the faces of my mum and dad, brother and sister. And I realized that this was it, that I was now blind. But I remember thinking that I didn't want to be blind, and I was just hoping that I could just wake up and be my normal self. But the reality was that my life had changed forever.
Because, Amma, your parents were told that you would lose your sight at some point when you were as young as 4, was it something you'd managed to prepare yourself for as a teenager? Or did it hit you incredibly hard when it actually happened?
I think it did hit me hard. Like, we knew that I was going to go blind, but it's just, you know, when you're a kid, you're so busy doing lots of different things and you don't really think, you know, you've not got experience at planning things and managing things. And my little brother and sister were blind as well. So we're like the 3 blind mice. And, you know, when it did come around, you know, I remember I was just, you know, just depressed, thinking, you know, why did this have to happen to me?
And was there a period of being low and angry, perhaps, and depressed for some time after you realised it had actually gone for good?
Yeah, I think it was a number of months, because I was about to start my degree, math, stats and finance, you know, because I always wanted to be an accountant. You know, I don't know why, but I remember thinking that this was it, that I would not be able to do anything. So I went down in a spiral of depression, thinking that life had ended. You know, there at the age of 18, people are out there, you know, learning to drive, dating, doing all the exciting things, you know, being a waiter, waitress. I mean, I thought, I can't do any of those things. And after being in my room, my mum saying you can't leave the house unaccompanied, I realized that we've only got one life, and either you just stay and be depressed, or, you know, you get out there And, you know, you take baby steps and try and see what you can do, because, you know, the alternative was just to sit there and do nothing and just watch the world go by. So suddenly I changed my mindset and I wasn't that confident. My teacher said that I couldn't study maths and stats and finance, and they said maybe just study something like politics or a history. But I really wanted to do maths, so I was very determined. So I head off and try to see what I could do.
And how did you manage to study maths? That does sound quite a difficult subject to study without your sight, just because of all the figures you're dealing with.
Yes, the lecturers didn't know how to deal with me. You know, the way I see it is, like, you know, if you think about equal learning systems, you know, the lecturers are a bit like zookeepers, if you think, and they're in charge of an elephant enclosure. The maths students are the elephants. They know how to deal with those guys really well. But suddenly, if you give them like a fish called Amr Latif, they don't know what to do with me, you know? And so I had to become my own leader. I had to find my own way of doing things. I had my own responsibility. There was no role models. You know, nobody had done maths in that uni. And so I'd experimented with lots of different methods. I tried Braille, that didn't work. And then I used cassettes and I got people to record maths onto cassettes. And some of the equations were so long that often one equation would take the entire side of a 60-minute cassette. And that method started to work. And it was great. I would be just lying in my bed, closed eyes, and just listening to these beautiful differential equations, and I was really happy. It really built my confidence. I was getting fantastic marks, so that was my first step up, where, you know, I took a step into the unknown and I built my confidence.
And before we move on to the other incredible things you've done and becoming an accountant and going off to study abroad, I just wondered how mum and dad coped with it all, because you're one of five, Amma, and as you mentioned, one of your brothers and one of your sisters is also blind. In fact, I think your mum and dad coined the phrase the three blind mice, didn't they? But
yeah.
But it must have been absolutely devastating for them to see their three children lose their sight. But how did they cope with it?
My dad really struggled. You know, he would always be looking at the newspapers to see if there was any cure. In fact, you know, when we were in our late teens, he took me and my brother to Spain because a Russian ship said that they had a cure for our blindness. And so off we went. We'd never been abroad on holiday, so this was great for us, you know. And when we got there, they didn't have a cure. And so my dad really struggled. And when I used to walk with my cane, my dad used to say, Amr, you don't need that. And I was like, Dad, I do, because I'm going to crash into things. Because he was Asian as well, so people view disability in a different way. But he was very supportive, because I remember when I was depressed, I was like, Dad, why should I go to university if I can't do a job afterwards? And he said, look son, let's take it step by step. So I got huge encouragement and inspiration from him. My mum was very supportive. She couldn't do enough for us. But she was very protective. She didn't want us to go out and leave the house unaccompanied, but gave us so much support and so much love. And you know, that helped us to get through.
And mum's still alive and well and giving you all that support and love right now, and desperately proud, isn't she, of what you get up to?
She is. And when she realised I had corona, I told her, Mum, you're in your 70s, you've got diabetes, whatever you do not leave the house. And when she saw that I was ill in my house, she jumped in the car, went to my sisters and said, we're going to drive from Glasgow to Leeds and look after our son. And my sister said, look, Mum, you're crazy, we can't. You know, she has so much love and, you know, I'm so lucky to have her.
And also, I mean, gosh, when we get onto your adventures, you know, there she was worried about you leaving your bedroom. You've gone to quite some extremes, haven't you?
Yeah,
if only she knew what you really got up to these days.
That's it.
So going back to your maths and your 2-1, not a first, the 2-1, wasn't it?
Well, the 2-1's very important. The 2-1 yes. Shows that I had a social life, you know, Helen. I hope you didn't get a first, because, you know, that's my excuse anyway.
Well, you were determined that you're going to become an accountant, and that's quite a story in itself, isn't it, about finding somebody who would take somebody on who couldn't see.
Exactly. After I graduated, I really struggled to get my foot in the door. I just kept facing rejection after rejection, and my friends were all landing great jobs and I just didn't know what was going on. And then one of the big top accountancy firms wrote to me and they said, Amar, lovely to meet you, but the reason why we haven't given you a job is because we just don't believe that a blind person could be an accountant. And you know, I found that really shocking, but also it made me realize, actually, it's true. These people just haven't got any experience of blindness. So I took matters into my own hands, and at my very next interview, I gave them an idea of blindness and about how, as a blind person, I would actually do the job. And I gave them some examples of successful role models, and it was brilliant. And it gave them an insight into how it could work. And so the next three jobs I went for, I managed to get them successfully. So it showed me that if you think outside the box, and if you're different, it works. And that gave me more renewed confidence.
So not only did you become an accountant, I mean, you became head of commercial finance for BT. I mean, you didn't do anything by half, did you there?
To be told that, you know, you couldn't be a blind accountant. And there I was, 7 years later, in charge of a department of fully sighted accountants. And I remember I used to just sit there and, just in awe of what was possible. And it was a great feeling.
We've spent a lot of time together travelling to different places over the last year. And one question I've never asked you is where your love of travel first came from. And I'm wondering if it was when you first went to Canada for your gap year.
Absolutely. I think that's where the spark was. And that happened. The reason I went to Canada was because my mum, my dad, my lecturers, everyone was really protective. You know, my mum and dad wouldn't let me go out of the house unaccompanied. And my lectures were quite protective. And so I decided that I didn't want to be wrapped up in cotton wool and live in a protective box for the rest of my life. So against the wishes of all of those people, I headed out to Canada with just me and my newly acquired blindness. And it was the best year of my life. You know, I met so many incredible people and I learned so much about myself and about the world around me. And I guess I realized that if you dare to push your limits and step outside your comfort zone, your world becomes bigger.
And there must have been challenges, though, along the way there, where the sort of leaving Glasgow and the safety of university and your bedroom and home and people who loved and cared for you. It was quite an adventure, that first one, wasn't it?
It was, because I signed up for it, but I didn't know how I would manage. I remember I was at the airport and my mum was in tears and I was a bit upset. But as soon as I got on the plane, I just had butterflies. I just couldn't believe it. I was going out to Canada, Toronto, didn't know anybody. I landed, got on a bus heading to this town, lovely, lovely town called Kingston. And it was right on the edge of Lake Ontario. And when I got there, I arrived maybe a month before all the other students. And so I got a chance to settle in, recruit people who were going to record my maths notes for me. And I was so excited. And it was daunting. But, you know, that's the thing. Push yourself out of your comfort zone. You know, you can really surprise yourself.
So through those 7 years as an accountant, did you start developing the bug for travel then?
Yeah, it was in the back of my mind. I thought, I haven't travelled much, but I had really fond memories of my exchange to Canada. And so towards the end of the 7 years, I had money to spend. But when I approached travel companies, I faced rejection. So I think that just kind of made me want to travel, and I felt limited. I felt claustrophobic. I thought, because I'm blind, will I never be able to travel again?
What did they say to you, Amar? Were they afraid to take you unless you'd got somebody with you, perhaps?
Absolutely. They said that I needed to bring a carer. And I thought, I don't need a carer, you know. I thought I could, pack my own bags, get dressed and brush my hair when I had it. And, And then they were also saying that you, even if you bring someone with you, you can't go on any of the adventure tours. So you couldn't go sailing, couldn't go skiing, couldn't go walking holidays. You basically couldn't do anything that was fun.
So that is where the idea came, isn't it? For your own travel company, Travelize. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so Travelize is a world unique international tour operator, and we take groups of blind and sighted people on holiday, and we do bring them back as well.
Usually.
Usually, yeah. We can lose about 10%. But the interesting thing is most of these people don't know each other, but each day we partner a sighted person with a different blind person, and in return for guiding and describing the sites, the sight travelers get to travel for a reduction in price. And, you know, we go everywhere. As you know, we do over 70 different destinations, and from walking holidays to sailing holidays, to more discovery tours to places like Cuba, Japan, and the more relaxing sunshine breaks like the Canaries and Mexico. Oh my God. I still got that spark. I still want to travel, Helen. Let's go somewhere.
Let's plan our adventure, our 2021 yes. adventure. But also sometimes being blind, you're allowed to do things, aren't you, that other people aren't. I'm thinking of perhaps when you went to the Terracotta Warriors.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible. You know, not only do we travel with Travelize, but when we get to places like in China, we get to touch the Terracotta Warriors. When we go to Peru, they open up the glass boxes and let us touch these ancient Inca artifacts. I mean, it's incredible. And people show you so much love. And, you know, when I took a group to the floating islands on Lake Titicaca in Peru, they'd never met blind people before. But when I took another group a few weeks later, they'd made a little model of their island so that the blind people could touch it. We've been to, you know, shanty towns in Cape Town in South Africa, where we've met the locals, and, you know, they've never met, you know, blind people like us before. And it's just incredible. With being blind, we end up just making so many connections. And obviously the sighted people love it, because, you know, some of these things that we do, they wouldn't be able to do on normal tours.
And sometimes the light dependent folk, as you affectionately call us, don't always have as much courage as the visually impaired, do they?
Absolutely. Like a moment comes to mind in Cuba, for example, you know, when I offered the group the chance to go skydiving, only the blind people wanted to do it. So there I was as a blind tour manager leading six blind people to this Soviet Russian helicopter, and our sighted travelers didn't want to do it. So they just waited at the bottom of the beach while these blind people just came out the sky.
Do you think there might have been a reason for that, Emma?
Yeah, I think they probably saw the look of the helicopter.
I'm interested to know where that entrepreneurial spirit comes from in the first place.
I think it must be from my dad, you know, because my dad grew up in Pakistan. When he was young, you know, like maybe 10 years old, he used to sell soap in his village in the local market. And one day he saw these exotic looking kids and said to somebody, you know, where do these people come from? And they said, oh, they come from a place called England. And my dad thought, right, they're so well-dressed and they're so well-spoken, I want to go there. So he got his two friends together. They got a car when he was in his mid-20s and drove all the way to the UK. And, you know, when he got here, he was rejected at the border in France. And he had this contact of this Belgian fisherman. And when he took one look at him and he goes, ah, I see the problem. You look too Pakistani. We've got to dress you up like an English gentleman. And he goes, an English gentleman always wears a bowler hat and a raincoat. And he has like a newspaper in one hand and an umbrella in the other. Anyway, cutting a long story short, he came to the UK, worked really hard in the cotton mills in Rochdale, and then set up market stalls, and then set up a string of businesses in Glasgow. And, you know, despite three of his children being blind, you know, he was able to do all that. So he's a huge, huge inspiration for me.
And did they dress him up in the bowler hat and the raincoat? Did they try and make him look more British?
They did. And it seemed to work. I mean, this was back in the 60s, you know, and because he was dressed the part, they put him in on the ferry, and he'd never been on a ferry before, and he was in, they put him in business class, and he remembers saying, oh, the British people were so kind, you know, they put me in this room, and when he arrived he was asleep, and they said, oh, Mr. Lateef, we're here now, come on, and they guided him and he got through.
Sadly, Dad isn't with us anymore, but before he died, did he feel a great sense of pride, Emma, when he saw you open Travel Eyes and do all the things that you've done, you know, since becoming blind at 18?
He was incredibly proud. I remember, you know, anybody he met, he would talk so fondly of me. In fact, he was better at marketing than I was. Initially, I used to get that teenage thing, you know, where you feel a bit cringy because your parents are talking highly of you. But then I realized he's actually really good at this, and he's the reason why we've set up our international schools program, you know, where we have students guiding our blind adults. Because one day a lady popped into his kebab shop in Glasgow, and she must have mentioned that she was an international teacher, and that's all he needed. And he told her about me, and before she left the shop, she had a kebab in one hand and a Guardian article about Travel Eyes in the other.
Is that because she said she was international and he thought that my son's international and global and all that kind of thing?
Exactly. It was just incredible. And now, over the last 10 years, we've worked with, you know, so many schools across the world, and that's made an incredible change. Like, teenagers are coming on the trip and guiding our blind adults, and it's giving them a sense of real sense of responsibility and leadership and helping to develop them. And it helps our visually impaired travelers, because, you know, when you're blind, you're usually on the end of receiving help, but our blind travelers are helping to develop these, you know, young students. So it's a win-win situation.
And of course, it isn't just the visually impaired people who get an awful lot out of these trips. I mean, I know firsthand how much a sighted person gets out of guiding a blind person. We'll come on to that in a minute. But in your opinion, Emma, what do sighted people take away from guiding people like you?
When they come on the trip, they report that they actually see the world, because these days we're so much into getting that perfect Instagram shot that we don't actually engage with what's around us. So by standing at a great view and describing it to your partner, you're actually seeing what's in front of you. And then with our multi-sensory aspects of the holiday, you get into taste and touch things and do experiences that you normally wouldn't. And the other thing is, our sighted travellers get so inspired by our blind travellers because they're not letting anything hold them back. You know, they're halfway around the world, they can't see, and they're with strangers that they don't know. And suddenly it helps them to put their problems into perspective. And, you know, and also, you know, a lot of people don't like travelling by themselves. So maybe they've lost their partners or their partners don't want to travel. So this is a great way of going away and not feeling like you're alone.
So there we were. We'd met for the very first time a few moments earlier. We were at Countryfile Live at Castle Howard. I'd nervously guided you onto stage. I was absolutely terrified that I was going to have some kind of calamity in front of the live audience of 400 people sitting there on their hay bales. And there we were in the middle of the interview talking about exactly this, how much a sighted person gets out of guiding someone who's visually impaired. And I know you remember this really well. I'd mentioned that I'd just climbed Mount Toopcal in the Atlas Mountains. I mean, I honestly thought that was a first and a last because I didn't realise how difficult it was. And I said to you on stage, I really wish I'd been able to share it with you, you know, the sounds and the smells and the tastes and everything. What happened next, Mr. Lateef?
Well, that was a fateful mistake on your part, Mrs. Fospero. So basically I said, well, you can. What are you doing next month? I'm taking a group of 26 adventurers up that mountain. Do you want to come and be my eyes? So then I said to the audience, look, she said that she would wish she could share it with me. So here's her opportunity. And I roped you in, didn't I?
You certainly did. I mean, guiding was an incredible experience. Just explain, Emma, to the listeners to our podcast, how we did it. Because we got to the summit, which was more than 4,000 metres high.
Absolutely. I mean, before I do that, I just want to say a huge credit to you. I can't believe how you just, you know, nervously guiding me on stage. I mean, Helen, your arm was like shivering. I was like, why are you shivering? She goes, oh, because I'm scared in case you fall off the stage. And then a month later, you're guiding me solo to the top of Mount Toopcal. And it was just incredible how you we managed to work together and do it. And it was just, in, you know, some of the terminology that you used, it was just so, so funny. You know, because on these mountains, there's massive drops on either side. So if Helen said, oh, you know, there's a 2,000 on your drop on your left and then the same on your right, I'm like, okay.
Well, it's just good that I'd got my left and right. I mean, correct, because there were moments where we were teetering on the edge and I really had to think hard about what was left and what was right. I mean, Mount Toothpell is a challenging climb for a sighted traveller, and I was nervous once I'd agreed to do it. You know, it's difficult if you can see, and how was I going to guide you? But what happened was you were behind me with one hand sort of on my left arm or on my rucksack. And I That's remember right. you saying to me, don't worry about describing every step, because your senses are heightened, aren't they? And you could feel my body sort of moving. So absolutely. I didn't have to describe absolutely every step to you.
Yeah, absolutely. So when someone's guiding me, like, I can feel you going up or down, and I can kind of hear your footsteps. So you never need to tell me step up, step down, because otherwise, you know, it's laborious and I don't really need it. And the other thing I'm blessed with is I've got big feet, so they're fine. I'm quite stable. And it was, your descriptions were amazing. And I remember as we were getting near the top, Helen, you were like, okay, I think altitude's hitting me. So I won't be able to describe for a little while. And I thought, oh, okay, we can enjoy a little bit of the piece. But then you outsourced it, didn't you, Helen?
I did. You must have been relieved that your ears were no longer bleeding. But as we were getting to the summit, what really struck me, Emma, was the views. They were so magnificent. I could see all the way across the Sahara Desert. And I didn't want you to miss out on that, but the air's really thin at the top, and I was tired and breathless, and we'd been climbing since about 5 a.m. The weather was cold, it was biting cold with high winds, but I got somebody else who wasn't guiding anyone to. I didn't want you to miss the description.
It was so, so thoughtful of you to, you know, like, outsource it, and, you know, you're very, very considerate, and, you know, it was such an incredible, incredible adventure, and I just can't believe you just decided to go for it in the spur of the moment.
I think humour is what keeps you going to a large extent, Emma. I mean, you've got a wonderful sense of humour. And I remember at the beginning when you said, let's record some film clips on our phone. And as one would expect, you passed the phone to me and said, come on, let's make some little films. And I hadn't taken my reading glasses on the trip. So you ended up actually doing the filming, didn't you? Which seemed all kinds of wrong and silly.
Yeah, it was weird, because I, you know, usually I'd pass my phone on to someone. So there I was, blind, climbing this mountain, you know, guided by you, and not only just doing that, but with one hand making a visual film of our experience and not being able to see it.
You've also been to some amazing places. I mean, away from our adventure and travelers, tell me a bit about the most unusual places that you've been to as an independent traveler.
Well, you know, I've been lucky. I've traveled so much, you know, and blindness has really helped me see the world. You know, I did a trip out to Nicaragua in Central America, where I trekked from the Atlantic coast to the Pacific Ocean through dense tropical jungles with crocodiles and piranha fish, and crossed a shark-infested lake and up a 5,000-foot volcano, as you do, to get to the finishing line. And that was 220 miles, and, you know, that was pretty incredible.
And you've just done a pilgrimage, haven't you, with celebrities like Adrian Charles and Edwina Curry and Fatima Whitbread. How was that?
Oh, it was such an incredible experience. It took us 2 weeks, went from Serbia through Bulgaria and Istanbul. And, you know, it was a lovely group. It was nice to meet them all. And, you know, we learned so much. It was about faith. And, you know, we saw how religion brings people together, like in the churches, mosques and synagogues, people, communities are getting together. But it also showed us the dark side of religion, you know, like the wars that have happened in the past. And, you know, but I like to think that, you know, now we're moving on, and, you know, religion can play a good role in the world.
And you struck up a wonderful friendship with Edwina, didn't you, on that trip?
Oh, yeah. Edwina is just absolutely incredible. And her descriptions were amazing again, just like yours, Helen. And it's so lovely when you meet someone that you can connect with. And she wants me to write my book, so she's constantly on my case, and she gives me a call so regularly. Have you started yet? And she wants me to write it now during lockdown.
It wouldn't be a bad idea to start writing it now.
And Fatima Whitbread, you know, she guided me on the mountains up there, and you know, she was going at such a pace, you know, with an Olympian when you're traveling. And you know, at the end of a day, a long day of walking, we'd get back to the hotel and I'd say, oh, Fatima, could you show me to my room? She goes, yeah, but do you mind if we go via the gym first?
So she kept you worked out on the trip.
She did. And I looked in good shape after that trip, actually.
I'm sure you did. Now, you do motivational speeches all over the world. What are the core messages that you try and get across, Amma, when you speak to businesses and schools and all the different people you speak to?
I guess the messages vary depending on, you know, what people want me to talk about, what the audiences are. But generally speaking, I think, you know, people live their lives where they're plodding along. But I think it's so important not to have limits on yourself and not let anybody else place limits on you. So just having that mindset, and I guess blindness gave me that mindset. I wouldn't necessarily have it, but you don't need to be blind. You don't need to have suffered some kind of adversity or some kind of problem to gain it. But just realizing that, you know, we only have one life and this isn't a dress rehearsal. So, you know, just grab opportunities with both hands and do it. You know, you push yourself, take baby steps, do something that you want to do. If it scares you, don't worry, you know, make it happen, and you know, you'll really surprise yourself. You know, there's a beautiful world out there, and you know, it's so important that you get out there, climb the mountains, and you know, see the views all around.
We do only have one life, and you gave us quite a scare, Amma, a few weeks ago when you were so poorly in hospital. You really did think your number was up for a day or two, didn't you, lying in that hospital room?
Absolutely. I was in a room with three other guys. You know, a few days later, one of the guys died, and, you know, he was such a lovely guy, and it was quite overwhelming with all the beeps of the machines and oxygen, and I was lying there thinking, I'm really struggling to breathe. And, you know, I thought the distance between living and dying is just that one breath. And I remember thinking to myself, I've done so much, you know, and I wanted to enjoy life even more. And is this it? Does it just end? And, you know, do I not get a chance to say goodbye to friends and family? And I was equally very inspired by the nurses. They were just so incredible. Despite being in their heavy protective gear, they were so cheerful. And, you know, they got me through. So, you know, a huge, huge thank you to all of them. You know, they do such an amazing job. And I'm just so lucky and happy to be alive. You know, I walk in my apartment every morning, I wake up, and I just so glad that I can breathe and that I'm here. And it's totally changed my mindset even more. So I'm going to be doing some absolutely ridiculous things going forward.
Oh, which that scares me, because I'll be likely roped in. I would imagine on one or two of those. But I'm so glad you've recovered, Amma. Before we let you go, give us a little tease. I know that you've just finished recording a really exciting programme for the BBC that we'll see on our screens later this year. We can't say what it is, but it's challenged you to a different level, hasn't it?
Oh my goodness. A few months ago, I would never have thought that I would be doing this. And I feel so bad that I can't say it, but it's absolutely ridiculous. People that know me are going to be absolutely shocked. And it's a program that's going to be coming out around about July and August. And that's all I'm going to say. It's absolutely ridiculous. So watch this space.
We certainly will watch this space. Amma, thank you so much. You're a pleasure to interview, and it's lovely to actually just take the time and chat to you.
I know, it's so natural chatting to you, Helen. I could chat to you all day. Thank you.
We will next year on our next adventure. Well, that was entrepreneur and TV presenter Amar Latif, who you'll see on your screens this summer on BBC One doing something that he's never done before. Thanks very much for listening today. Please feel free to share the Convex Conversation on socials or by email. You'll find us at convex.podbean.com, on Spotify, and we're also on Apple Podcasts. Stay well. I'll be back next week. Bye for now.